So we have two handouts. They're still going around. So if you don't, maybe just raise your hand. If someone in front can help bring them around, that would be great. And in addition, you hot? Ready? Nori, okay. No, not these. Okay, in addition, what I've done is to anticipate your questions. I have printed off my slides so at the end of the night you could take them with you. But I don't want to give them out now because then there's no point in making slides. I may as well have just written up my notes for you. And all this hard work would have gone for naught. So there's actually a funny comic. At one point, there's a video of a yeshiva. And guy by guy comes in and they all put their recorders down in front of the teacher. And then they all leave. And by the end, the Rebbe's sitting there in front of like 600 recorders. So maybe I'll do that next time. I'll record the class, put it on, and... Okay. A lot of noise, a lot of excitement. I'll put you to sleep soon. Don't worry about it, so you don't have to. I also want to mention we have not one, but two important guests this evening. I have to my right over here, my mom and my wife. One is my biggest fan, one is my biggest critic. I won't tell you which is which. That way I keep you guessing. That way I'm... it's always a pleasure. I think it's actually the first class that my wife has heard since we moved to Boca. Right. So we'll see if she comes back. Okay. I want to do two things with everyone this evening. I want to do two things. We're going to study two incredible personalities, as you see on my slideshow. The Ramban, Moshe ben Nachman, who lives at essentially the 13th century, and the Abarbanel, Yitzchak ben Yehuda Abarbanel, who lives pretty much in the 15th century. Now, I'll explain why it's not haphazard that the two of them are being covered in one evening, and obviously I'll explain that as the night goes along. I want to do two things tonight. Two very simple goals. Number one is expose you to these two personalities. So everyone should leave this room knowing who Ramban was, who Abarbanel was, where they fit historically, why they were significant commentators. That's number one. Number two, and I will add equally important, is to open these works up to you so that you don't just know the history, right? Otherwise, we could just call this a history class. I don't want you to just know the history. I want it so that if you were to open up a piece of the Ramban, it's not a closed text to you. You're going to understand the context with which the Ramban is writing. You'll understand why he references certain things, why he dislikes certain things, etc. When you open up a piece of the Abarbanel, writes with the exact same strategy each and every time. Every piece of the Abarbanel looks exactly the same. So when you open up a piece of the Abarbanel, even though it's long and it's tedious and it's verbose and it's small print, you'll understand the basic structure and the basic format within which the Abarbanel is writing. So those are my two goals. A, to understand their personalities, to expose you to them, and B, to open the world of the text to you. And we're going to do that by studying some of the text. But again, the minutia of the studying we're going to be doing is less important than the structure of what we're doing. I want you to walk out of this room knowing the structure of each of those texts. Who are they speaking to? Who are they arguing with? Who are they in a polemic against? Right? All of those will help you understand those texts very much. Okay. Let's look at some of the historical context. So if you open up your sheets, we're on page 2. You should see something that says timeline and relevant dates. And I will go through some of them as well with you, but I want to look at them. What we have here is a map of the Mediterranean basin. Okay, I'm definitely in someone's way, no matter where I stand. So I'll try to dance around a little bit so that I make everyone equally unhappy. Okay, let's just go through our Northern Africa, Spain, European geography. Okay? We have here Spain. That's where we are going to be centered this evening. That's going to be our main focus. You have Portugal right over here. You have Northern Africa, so you have Morocco, Algeria, Libya, Egypt, Saudi, right? And then we come into the Middle East. Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, Turkey, right off the map over here is going to be Iraq, Iran, etc. Okay? You have over here Italy and France, Germany up here. Okay, so what we're going to be focusing on over here is this area, but I'll explain why I brought this map in a second. In 630 CE, Muhammad dies. And the caliphate, which is a dynasty of leaders in Islam, begins. A couple of years later, in 636, Omar, that's why you say it's the Islamic conqueror under Omar, Omar is the fourth caliph, takes over and starts conquering essentially the entire Mediterranean basin from Iraq over here all the way until Spain. It's actually one of the largest conquests in history. Okay, it's a tremendous amount of land. And at the end of this period, you essentially have 90% of world Jewry living under Islamic control. Okay, now, we pointed this out in the past, the irony of Jewish history, which is that the Islamic regimes have generally been more friendly to us than our Christian friends, which may or may not be the case nowadays, depending on who you ask. But certainly back then, as we'll see, the Jews were very prosperous under Islamic control. Don't forget, in Iraq, you still have the Gaonim, right? We learned 2 weeks ago about the conclusion of the Talmud, right, with the Babylonia, with the Gaonim, that go all the way up until the 11th century. So that's still all going on over there. So you have a tremendous amount of world Jewry, all living under Islamic control, again, from the Mediterranean basin to the Iberian Peninsula to Iraq. It's a tremendous amount of the world. 711. In 711, they conquer Spain from the Visigoths and begin what is called the Moors' control of Spain. Okay, so now we're going to move to our Spanish map. So again, you have France up here, Portugal, Morocco, Algeria. Up here is going to be Germany. Okay? Now you'll notice automatically, what do you notice before I even say anything? Right? You learned last week, you've been learning a little enough about Jewish history, something should jump out at you. Which is the proximity, again, it wasn't a trick question, right? The proximity of France and Spain. Now France and Spain, which you, I know that's an obvious thing, but I'm going to elaborate upon it a little bit, right? France and Spain represent dramatically different heritage, right? Dramatically different approaches to Judaism within our religion. And that's obviously going to be very important for us this evening, because what we're going to be focusing on is right about up here, for the first part, Gerona, which as you'll see is basically right on the border of France and Spain. So again, in 711, the Islamic conquers from the Visigoths, the Moors' control of Spain begins, and what you have is the Jews begin the golden age in Spain. So we have here the Omar, we have 711, the Moors' control of Spain, and the Andalusia is going to be called the area of Muslim Spain. Let's take that off. Okay? You begin the golden age of Spain, which is one of the most productive stages in all of Jewish history. What personalities do we know are going to live during this time period? So we'll have the Rambam, we'll have the Kuzari, we'll have Bachya ibn Bakuda, who wrote the Chovas Halavavos. That's all going to be during this time period. Right, so the area of Muslim Spain is going to be called Andalusia, and I'm just going to take these off for a second, because I want to show you. Okay? If you look on your map, so turn to page 3. You have here a map of Spain. And what I want to show you is between the four maps, don't look up here, look there right now. What you have here on your four maps is the progression, or what I'll call the deterioration, of Islamic control in Spain. So if you look in 790, which is the top left-hand corner, you'll notice on the top there's a black line, so to speak, going across. That's what's going to separate Islamic control of Spain versus Christian control of Spain. You'll notice the black line is going to be the border between Christian Europe and Muslim Spain. And in 790, it's almost all what? It's almost all Muslim. Go to 900. Where's the line going? Up or down? It's going down. By 1150, it's further down. By 1300, it's hard to see, but it's basically just that bottom right-hand corner, right over Gibraltar. I can't read that, but I assume that says Gibraltar. Okay? So you have, is that's what we're going to call the Reconquista, okay? Which is essentially the Christians taking back control of the Iberian Peninsula from the Islamic kingdom. That's going to happen from 800 to 1500. Now, why am I sharing this all with you? Right? Why does this all matter to us? Because as you look at the maps, not here, but here, right, when you look at the maps on your sheet, you'll notice that northern Spain progressively becomes more Christian, whereas southern Spain remains Islamic longer, but eventually also becomes under Christian control. Now again, that's going to be very important for us because they represent distinct heritages to our people. In other words, as one takes over from the other, different influences will infiltrate their society. Continuing on with our history, essentially then, this area, these lines, as it moves down, is going to be the battlefront between the Muslims in Africa, which are going to be down here, and the Christians, which are going to be up north. So let's go here, right? The Christian Europe starts around here. Islamic Africa is here. In Spain, becomes the crossroads between those two different cultures. And essentially, it becomes the intersection between Christian Europe and Islamic Africa. And as the Christians push down on Spain, the influences of Christian Europe are going to come with it. And the influences of Islamic Spain are going to be minimized. Okay? Now, as I'll explain in a second, and I'm jumping ahead, but just to wet your palate, the Ramban is born right over here, which is going to mean that he is at the epicenter of those crossroads. Right? He is going to be, and even if you look, he's really pretty much under European Christian throughout his entire life, but he essentially serves as the crossroad between Spain and France in those two rich traditions and cultures. And that's going to be the significance, that's going to be the exciting component of what we're going to do tonight. Okay, let's just go through a couple more keywords. So we have the Reconquista, then we have the Golden Age of Spain, during the time that Jews were generally accepted in society, and Jewish religious, cultural, and economic life blossomed. Okay? Finally, in 1148, the Almohades invade Spain. They are another Muslim tribe, but they are not as open-minded as the Moors were. They weren't as sympathetic to the Jews. And it essentially symbolizes, in 1148, the end of the Golden Age of Spain. Now, these Almohades, where do we know them most famously from? Anyone want to take a guess?
The
Almohades. We know them from a famous letter that was written. The Rambam, anyone ever heard of Igeret HaTayman?
Yes.
Right? Igeret HaTayman. So the Rambam wrote to the Jews of Tayman. And essentially, the purpose of that letter was after the Almohades had taken over, so they were essentially forcing people to subscribe to Muhammad. They were forcing them to say, Muhammad is God. So the Jews wrote a letter to Rambam, basically saying, are we terrible Jews because we said it? Right? We didn't want to die, so we said it. Now that, again, we're going to come to this later on, is a general difference between what takes place in more Sephardi cultures and what takes place in Christian cultures. In Christian cultures, in the Ashkenazi world, of France, Germany, etc., you're much more likely to find death as opposed to conversion. Right? When given the choice between death and conversion, the Jews in the Ashkenazi communities will more often than not choose death. In the Sephardi cultures, they will more often than not choose conversion. Okay? So when the Almohades pass through Yemen and they convert all of these Jews, they write a letter to the Rambam and they say, are we horrible? Can we ever do tshuva? Can we ever repent? And the Rambam writes back a very famous letter basically giving them chizuk, giving them strength in their conviction, saying, don't worry about it. We all know that you're practicing Judaism. We all know that you just said it as a verbal declaration, but it means nothing to you. And perhaps Muhammad's not so problematic because they're monotheistic. And therefore he says, say it in public, be Jewish in private, you don't have to worry about it. Okay? That's where we know the Almohades from. But they really sweep all across, getting all the way until Spain. In 1270, the Muslims, again, you can look at your map here, They are confined to this little area down here, which is essentially Granada, in the most of Spain, by 1270, is under the control of Christian Europe. As the Almohades are taking over, by the way, before we even get right, as the Almohades are taking over, just to take a step back, the Jews are moving northward. So the Jewish migration is taking from southern Spain to northern Spain. But again, by 1270, the Muslims have been confined, and most of Spain is under Christian control. Now, what do the Christians do? Are they as friendly as the Muslims or not? Not as friendly as the Muslims. Generally a good guess in Jewish history, right? That's when they start converting the Jews. It's where you begin to have the conversos, and you have an entire population of Muranos living in Spain at that time. Now, we know the Muranos already from a couple of hundred years later, when 1492, etc. But it already began much earlier with the control of the Christians over Spain. Finally, in 1480, the Catholics decide to Christianize or kill everyone in Spain. And in 1492, just a few years later, the Christians take over Granada as well, and they control all of Spain. The expulsion edict is issued. 450,000 Jews are expelled from Spain, and they spread out all over the place. So again, let's just summarize. Why am I sharing all these dates with you? Because I want to show you what started off as a primarily Islamic country, or under Islamic influences, Spanish Northern Africa and influences, suddenly gets crushed by Christian European influences, until ultimately expulsion in 1492, when you essentially have no more Islamic influence in Spain. It's all under Christian European control. Okay? Now I want to point out three places to you that we are going to have to keep in mind. The first one is Catalonia. I'm probably botching that name, but you'll forgive me. Okay, that's where the Ramban is going to be born, in Girona. I'll go back to the map in a second. I'll show you all these. The second is Lisbon in Portugal, where the Abarbanel is born. And the third, is Provence. Now, was anyone at my French class last week? A couple people. So you know Provence well. Provence is where in France? Southeast. Southeast France. What's that bordering on?
Spain.
Right? Provence is, as you see over here, it's a great Torah center in the times of the Tosafists, right? The Baalei Tosafot, the additions to the Gemara, the Ashkenazi German rabbis who add glosses onto the Talmud, they are existing essentially on that border between Spain and France. Now I just want to go back to the map to show you those three places. Okay, so we have here Girona. That's where the Ramban is going to be born. We have Lisbon over here in Portugal. Okay, and what was the third place? Oh, Provence. So Provence is going to be right around
southeast.
So that's this right, southeast. Right, so it's right around over here. Okay? Now one more thing I want to point out. Here's Cordova. Who's born in Cordova famously? The Ramban. So immediately you'll know that although these look very close to each other, where the Ramban is born and where the Rambam is born, what separates them? Everything, right? Because Cordova is going to be under Islamic control for a lot longer, whereas Girona, already by 900, which is before Ramban is even born, is going to be under Christian European control. So that by the time the Ramban is born, he's essentially mostly Christian Europe, but again with a little bit of influence from Northern Africa as well. And just one more point I want to point out about Provence. What else famously is happening in Provence at that time, in addition to the Baalei Tosafists? What is being discovered, again, for the first time in 1,000 years? Kabbalah. Okay? The Kabbalah, really, from the time of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, supposedly, up until the France, the Provence rabbis, takes a little bit of a break. It's rediscovered in Provence. Okay? And from there, it's going to go to Israel and to Tzfat, where it'll have its renaissance in the 15th century, 16th century. Okay? So that's all happening right over here. So you see where the Ramban is going to be living, is, which is why, if you noticed, my title was the crossroads of the genius of intellectual crossroads. because that's where he is. He's sitting right in the cross between France and Spain, right in the cross between Islamic Spain and Christian Europe, and that's the melting pot into which the Ramban is going to be born. Any questions with the history? That would mean that everyone understands it, or no one understood anything. Okay?
Okay. The Crusades are in the same time when the...
So the Crusades are, right, the Crusades are primarily, again, you have pogroms everywhere, but when we talk about the Crusades, we're talking France, Germany, up here. Okay, when we talk about the Crusades of 1096 and the 12th century, those are primarily taking place up there. Okay. Why are we doing the Ramban in Abarbanel in the same evening? Why did we choose that? So the answer is the following. Hold on a second. Okay, Ramban and Abarbanel. Why are we doing them in the same evening? Number one, because the Ramban is the first great scholar of Christian Spain. And number two, because the Abarbanel is the end of Christian Spain. So whereas the Ramban, who's going to be born in, what did I have the dates here? In 1194, right? So essentially the beginning of the 12th century. What happens at the right around that time? That's when the Christians are pushing the Islamic control into just that small area of Granada. Okay? So the Ramban is basically born into Christian Spain. He's the first major rabbinic personality who sits at those crossroads. And Abarbanel, right, who we know a little bit about his biography just because it's a famous biography, he's going to be in the palace as the edict of expulsion is given, and so therefore he's going to be the last personality of Christian Spain. That's why the two of them, I mean, that's one of the reasons why the two of them are, both, right? In addition, both bring biblical commentary to a new level. And that's partially what we're going to discuss tonight. Both build upon their predecessors, but are going to open up an entire world of biblical commentary to us that was closed previously. And number two, fascinating and unique, is that both are going to look at things from multiple perspectives at the same times. They are the ultimate multitaskers. Whereas Rashi, who you learned about last week, had primarily one identifiable goal. Ibn Ezra, who you learned last week, had one identifiable goal. He was going to be the grammarian. You learned about Rashbam last week, that he had one goal, etc. These guys, with all these two personalities, are going to come along and you're going to have difficulty limiting them to one goal. What you'll see is that they incorporate all of the following into their works. Historical, right? We're going to learn pieces by the Abarbanel tonight, which are obviously going to speak very personally about his experiences and how that impacts his biblical commentary. Polemical. We'll see that part of what the Ramban is upset about are other people's attempts to minimize Midrash. And so the Ramban's going to come along and emphasize that. Theological, ethical, philosophical, grammatical. They're all going to be working on multiple levels at the same time in a very dynamic, charismatic way. And that's what's going to make their commentary unbelievably exciting. Because it's not one-dimensional, it's multidimensional. Not only is it multidimensional, but it's multidimensional working on multiple planes at the same time. Okay? So it's these similarities coupled with this that we are studying these two personalities in the same evening. And I want to suggest the following thesis. Let's talk about the Ramban for a second. Let's start with the Ramban. As we talk about the Ramban, we talk about the first great biblical exegete of Christian Spain. Just a little bit about his biography. He's born in 1194 in Girona, which is thoroughly Christian area, but traces of Muslim Spain still exist. Remember, he is at that crossroads, right as the Christians are pushing down. That's where he is existing. So he's thoroughly in Christian Spain, but there's still enough influences from Islamic Spain or Muslim Spain to interact with him. Now, if the Ramban is born in 1194, who famously does he overlap with for a very short period of time?
Rashi.
Rashi, who else?
Rambam.
Rambam, right? Rambam dies in what year? 1204. Okay? So he's going to overlap with the Rambam for 10 years. Now, we would think that's not a significant amount of time. But, as we'll see, there's a tremendous amount of overlap between the two of them. In 1232, in 1232, you have the Maimonidean controversy, which essentially divides the Sephardi and Ashkenazi communities about whether or not the Rambam's works are too Aristotelian, whether they're too rational, whether they're etc., etc., etc. This whole controversy bursts out between the Sephardim and the Ashkenazi. In the Ramban, Nachmanides steps in as a mediator, so to speak. He comes along and says, maybe Rambam's books are not so bad. Maybe there's something to be gained from them, but maybe it's not meant for the masses. And that's kind of the compromise that Ramban is able to strike, again, between the Sephardi communities, which embraced the Rambam, and the more Ashkenazi communities, which thought the Rambam was heresy, and the Ramban was able to broker that deal. Now again, that obviously happens after the Rambam dies, but you see already that the impact of the Rambam's life is having a profound impact on Nachmanides, the Ramban's life. Because that's the first moment where he's essentially catapulted into the spotlight as a rabbinic personality, and that's going to be his first major entranceway into rabbinic literature. Now, as we know, 1232, what happens 10 years later? Right, the Maimonidean controversy starts in 1232. What happens in 1242? In France, Paris. The book burning, right? They burned the books. Well, excuse me. 10 years earlier, they burned the books of the Rambam. And in 1242, they come along and they burn the books of the Talmud. Yes. That's what leads, by the way, again, this is parenthetical, Bachi ibn Pekuda, who wrote the Chovat HaLevavot, Shari Tshuva. The author of the Shari Tshuva, Rabbeinu Yonah of Gerona, now we know where Gerona is, that's going to be northeast Spain. So Rabbeinu Yonah over there is going to come along, and he was one of the anti-Maimonideans, and he's going to come along and say, maybe we did the wrong thing. Right? Maybe the reason why our Talmuds were burnt about 10 years later was because we burnt the Rambam's books in 1232, and so he writes a book called Shari Tshuva, which means the gates of repentance, almost as a mea culpa for what he did against the Rambam. Nonetheless, this is really Nachmanides' introduction into the world of Jewish scholarship. But what's going to be a profound difference between the two of them? The Rambam is going to be highly influenced by which cultures?
Islam.
Muslim Spain, Muslim tradition. And Ramban is going to be a student of Christian tradition. Okay? In 1263, again, this is just biography of the Ramban's life. 1263, there's a famous disputation of which the Ramban participated between Pablo Cristiani and the Ramban, right? We learned about this a couple years ago. We showed a video about it. Rabbi Goldberg gave a class about it. I'm not going to delve too deeply into it, but what I want to point out is a few points. Number one, at this point, the Christian polemics reach a new level. Okay? Why do they reach a new level? There were always these disputations. What makes the one with the Ramban famous, other than the fact that it had to do with the Ramban, is that the old one simply looked at Tanakh and tried to prove Judaism wrong by the verses of Tanakh itself. The disputation between Pablo Cristiani and the Ramban was the first time they used our own sources. They used Gemara. They used Agada to prove that Mashiach had already come, that Jesus is the Mashiach, etc., etc., etc. So what does Ramban have to do? Ramban is boxed into a corner. Because Pablo Cristiani is using all of these Agadic texts, all of these pieces of the Talmud to come along and to say, see, your Judaism proves that our Christianity is right. Nachmanides is boxed into a corner. So what does he do? Anyone remember? He says, you're right. And that's why we don't believe that Agada or Midrash or Agadic Talmudic statements are meant to be taken as authoritative. Right? That we don't base our beliefs on them, that they're only sermonic, that they're there to teach us lessons. Now, as you can imagine, that's going to get the Ramban into a little bit of trouble. Right? Because the rest of the Jewish community isn't ready to hear that. And there's a dispute among scholars whether Ramban says that simply because he was boxed into a corner or whether he really believes it. But he nonetheless says it. Again, that's how he gets out of the pickle with the disputation. Because of the dispute, in 1267, Ramban runs away to Israel, which, as we'll see from many of his writings, he pines for. He writes about Israel a tremendous amount in his texts, and in 1270, he passes away. Okay? That's the basic outline of the life and times of the Ramban. Noteworthy works. So we have, of course, here his Perush HaRamban al HaTorah, his writings on the Torah. We have Chidushei HaRamban, which are his writings on Shas, on the Talmud. This is not necessarily one of his most famous ones, but I thought it might be recognizable, so I took it. Igeret HaRamban, which is a letter that he wrote to his son. And Kitvei HaRamban, which is a collection of writings and articles and discourses that were collected, written by him. So for example, you could read the entire disputation in here. You can read letters that he wrote about free will in here. That's all going to be collected in a two-volume set. Now when we talk about his Chidushim on Shas, he has many famous students. I'm just going to name a few of them just so you could have a little bit of name recognition. The Ritva, the Rashba, the Ra'ah, the Ran. Those are all going to be, these are major personalities. They are all directly students of the Ramban, certainly when it comes to his Talmudic studies. Most famously, perhaps, what's the Ramban famous for? His arguments with the Rambam. The Rambam had come along with a Sefer, a Mitzvos, a book of Mitzvos, a calculating what the 613 Mitzvos are. The Ramban writes a gloss on those, disagreeing with many of them. Okay? And again, that's what he's going to be famous for as well. Let's go now. We had a lot of introduction. Let's go now into his actual commentary. And turn for that to page 4, source number 1. Okay. Okay. Page 4. This is the Ramban and his introduction to the Torah. So we will read the English, because there's no need to read the Hebrew. In the name of God, source number 1. Again, page 4, source number 1. In the name of God, the great, the almighty, the awesome, I shall begin to write original insights in interpreting the Torah. To go forth in the steps of my predecessors, the lions of the group, the eminent ones of the preceding generations, possessors of might and wisdom. To enter with them into bearing the thick beam. To write as they did explanations for scriptures, midrashim, agadot, fully arranged and guarded. I shall set as the light of my face the lights of the pure menorah, the commentaries of Rav Shlomo. Who's Rav Shlomo? So I cheated for you there. Rashi. So he says, I'm going to use Rashi. Crown of delight, diadem of splendor. I assume that's supposed to be crowned with excellent repute in his knowledge of scripture, Mishnah, and Gemara. How does he speak about Rashi? Positive, very flowery terms. He loves Rashi. To him belongs the right of the firstborn. Why does he call him the right of the firstborn? Right, he calls him he's the first major figure. I will contemplate his words and absorb myself in their love. And about them we will conduct discussion, examination, analysis about his explanations and his expositions in every formidable agada that are mentioned in his commentary. So let's stop here. What he says basically is, I'm going to build myself off the text of Rashi. I love Rashi, but I'm going to expound upon it. Now we'll see, he doesn't always love Rashi. He sometimes disagrees with Rashi, but Rashi is going to be his foundation. And in fact, as we'll learn, anytime you see a piece by the Ramban, more often than not, who's he going to start with? Rashi. He'll quote Rashi, and then it says, Veli Nira, but to me it seems that Rashi is incorrect, and here are the following 15 reasons. Okay, but he clearly has a tremendous amount of respect, reverence, for the position that Rashi holds in the chain of tradition, and for Rashi's commentary itself. Then we come to the last two lines. And with Avram ibn Ezra, and with this other guy, Ibn Ezra, we will have both open remonstration and hidden admiration. The English doesn't fully capture it, so I'm going to read the Hebrew. Okay? Second to last line. Vim Rabbi Avram ben Ibn Ezra, tiyalim tochacha migula, there'll be open rebuke, open rebuke, v'ahava misutara, and hidden love. Now, as many have commented, I saw this great quote by an article I was reading, that it said that Ramban filled his commentary with open rebuke, but where is the hidden love? Right? Now, as we'll see, he's not always so friendly in talking about Ibn Ezra. So you get the rebuke in a very overt way, but the love is a little bit more hidden. Okay? Now, why does he not like Ibn Ezra? So, if anyone remembers to last week, what was Ibn Ezra's calling card? Anyone here last week? Yeah. Anyone not revolting last week? Right. Specific, literal, that he essentially was a cavalier treatment of Agada. He rejected all usage of Agada, of Midrash, which again pinned him against Rashi. He was overly rationalistic exegesis. Right? Again, he's not going to utilize Midrashim, Kabbalah, any of that. And number three is a pretension to esoteric wisdom. Again, he's a philologist, he's a grammarian, he's a rationalist, and those three things are going to rub Ramban the wrong way. Okay? Quick question?
Just positive, that's so important. I'm positive about the opening. Someone so Islamic, do they take it from us? Or how does he open that? Is it something that...
What do you mean, how does he open it? Oh, where did he get that? I don't know. Are you saying, why did he write that way? He's a lot of praise God. Yeah. Flowery. That a lot of, if you read any introductions, a lot of them begin with such flowery terminology. Okay. Right. Right, exactly. Is that? Okay. The problem is you find it elsewhere also. My dream one day is to, and I don't think anyone will come, which is why I haven't given it, but I would love to do, the introductions to texts are sometimes even better than the texts themselves. That happens to be true. The introductions give tremendous biographical information, stylistic information. It's so rich, but no one reads them. So I'd love to give a class on like the 10 greatest introductions to, you know, major texts, but I'm not convinced people are interested in that because it's a little in depth. Okay. Now what's interesting about these two? So he invokes Rashi and Ibn Ezra. Rashi and Ibn Ezra are two very different personalities. Rashi represents the French, German, Ashkenazi traditions. Rashi combines Pshat and Drash. You all know this because you learned it last week. I'm just reminding. Okay? He combines Pshat and Drash. Rashi, using the what I'll call the Ashkenazi way, essentially, is to find contradictions and to try to resolve contradictions. When we learn about Tosfot later on, that's what Tosfot do. They'll find a Gemara, they'll find a contradiction with another Gemara, and they'll try to reconcile that. Rashi does the same thing within the text of the Talmud. Okay? So Rashi is doing all three of these things. Ibn Ezra comes along, he's not influenced by French, German, Ashkenazi traditions, he's living in Muslim Spain. He's a superb grammarian. He's not interested at all in Haggadah, in the Drash, in the Midrashim. That, he could care less about that. Nor, and lastly, does he believe that every biblical word, ooh, that's supposed to be profound significance. Right? In other words, he doesn't believe, let's say, there's a repetition of the word in Tanakh. So sometimes Rashi will come along and say, every word must have meaning, every word must have significance, so this extra word must come along and teach us something. Comes along in Ezra and says, why does it have to teach us anything? Sometimes people repeat themselves. Right? Think about a drasha from Rabbi Goldberg. Oftentimes he'll use like 11 different adjectives to get to a point. Right? So sometimes that's just how people speak. They speak and repeat themselves. They speak to emphasize things. But there's no cosmic significance necessarily that Ibn Ezra suggests to why the words are what they are. Now, just seeing these two against each other, they are dramatically different approaches to how to study Tanakh, to how to study the Bible. Okay? And Ramban says in his introduction that I am going to utilize both of them in my explanation of the text itself. Okay? Now that's going to be interesting. Because when I call the Ramban the crossroads, or the intellectual crossroads of that period, now it's starting to make sense. And that's why I began with all of our history. Because I wanted you to appreciate that he literally does sit at the crossroads, and that manifests itself that historical significance of, or geographically, where the Ramban is living, is not just a nice historical fact, but it directly influences how he cultivates, how he comes to his explanation on the Torah. He's using, man, picture my map up here. He's using stuff from up there, and he's using stuff from up below there. And he's going to serve as the bridge between those two rich traditions. Sometimes he's going to agree with Rashi, and he's going to defend the Drash, he's going to defend the Midrashim. And sometimes he's going to say, Rashi, you're a little bit out of line, and he's going to side with Ibn Ezra and say that's the correct approach. Okay? Yeah.
Can you compare their writing period of the 50-year difference in cultural atmosphere?
It's like saying, is there a difference between 2012 and 1980? So you and I would say there are profound differences between 2012. But there are more generalities than there are differences. Right? We could characterize the last 30 years of Jewish history in American history in a couple of terms if we wanted to. So there are always going to be differences. But overall, when we talk about broad periods of Jewish history, I'm trying to break it down into categories to enable us to understand the context of everything. Okay? Oh, here we go. This is what I want to show you. When we talk about the intellectual crossroads, and we talk about the Ramban, so we talk about from a parshanut, from a biblical exegesis perspective, he's going to be the melting pot of Rashi Ibn Ezra, of those two rich traditions. He's also, let's start with the Talmud, he's going to be the merging of the Tosafists. Don't forget, the Tosafists are up here on our map. Spain doesn't have an introduction to them yet, until the Ramban is going to integrate part of what the Tosafists try to do into his works, and that's ultimately going to filter in down our map as we get into the more Islamic parts of Spain. Okay, so when we talk about the Talmud, he's the first of the Sephardi Jews to encounter the works of the Baalei Tosfos. Okay, now what does that mean, the works of the Baalei Tosfos? What would characterize their approach? So I referenced it a little bit earlier. It's the dialectical approach to study, okay, which essentially means the give and take, the arguments, the comparing of sources. Right? You look in a Tosfos, they're going to quote three Gemaras, say they all disagree with each other, now we have to figure out how to reconcile them. Rashi does the same thing in the Torah. He'll quote one part of the Torah, he'll say, wait a second, this word is used elsewhere, they don't necessarily blend well together, how can we resolve it? Or one story in the Torah doesn't sit well with another story in the Torah, how can we resolve it? The Sephardi tradition of the Gaonim is very different. Okay, the Gaonim are not interested in the give and take. What are they interested in? Anyone know? The bottom line. Right, Gaonic writing is much more end-driven. Ashkenazi writing is more process-driven. Okay, and I'll give you a good example of this. Who's the first, this is just a piece of interesting trivia, and by the end of all these classes, you'll know the answer to this, guaranteed. Who's the first personality to create one centralized body of Ashkenazi law? No. The Tor, Rabbeinu Asher, okay, the son of the Rush. Okay? Rabbeinu Asher is the first person, the Tor, which was the precursor, right? Rav Yosef Karo with the Beit Yosef, which was a commentary on the Tor. Then when he realized, this is an interesting historical fact, he writes in his introduction to the Shulchan Aruch, that the reason why he wrote the Shulchan Aruch, the codified book of Jewish law, was the Beit Yosef is very verbose. And he realized that people don't read it if it's too long. So he had to rewrite his Beit Yosef, basically, with a bottom line agenda. Saying, okay, no one wants to know the give and take. That's boring to people, so let me give you the bottom line. But the Torah is the first one to take, from an Ashkenazi perspective, years and years and years of rabbinic literature, and say, here's the bottom line. Now, Torah doesn't live until when? I don't have the exact date on my mind, but it's going to be 15th century. That's relatively late. From a Sephardi perspective, who's the first major personality to gather together all of their traditions into a codified book of law? Before the Ramban. Much before. The Rif, Rabbeinu Alfasi, who lives already at the time of Rashi in the 11th century. I believe he dies 1104. The Rif, in his We find him in the back of the Talmud. Again, this is parenthetical, but it's interesting, right? We find him in the back of the Talmud. What does he do and what does not he do? He only quotes the halachic parts of the Talmud and sifts through the agadic parts of the Talmud. So essentially what he does is he takes out all of the give and take and drives you closer to the bottom line. Rambam bases himself off the riff, off the methodology of the riff. Now again, you're going to see this as the classes go along, but why do I show this to you? Because I want you to see that there are profound differences between what the Tosafists are doing in France, what the Gaonim are doing in Iraq, in the Sephardi cultures, and where are those merging at the crossroads of the Ramban. He's going to be one of the first major personalities that exposed to all of these worlds from a Talmudic study perspective, and he's going to incorporate all of them into his Talmudic discourses. Now, tonight we happen to not be speaking about his Talmudic part. We're talking about his Torah part. But I just want you to appreciate that. Okay? Secondly, Kabbalah. Where was Kabbalah? In Provence, which is southern France. Again, we take for granted they didn't have email, they didn't have Twitter and Facebook where you can, you know, this is the new trends. They didn't have that stuff. They required people to carry trends from one, what I'll call, not just geographical location, but one cultural location to another cultural location. Things moved by people. In fact, there's a very famous work called the Sefer HaManhig. Okay? The Sefer HaManhig essentially went from place to place. And all he does, his entire book, is simply recording what happened in place to place. Right? For him, that was interesting. Because what happened in Boca Raton was different than what they did in the Five Towns, which was different than what they did in Dallas, Texas. Now, I know that because I can follow what these shuls are doing on email and websites. They didn't have that back then. So he, for a life passion, decided that he would travel from town to town and just basically take a diary of what was happening in town, in each town. For us, that's incredible. That's because it allows us historically to understand what's taking place in what he used to do is not just observe and write, but he would bring it from one place to another. So he'd, for example, write that I came to Toledo and I found that they were doing this. And then when I went to this place, I told them what they were doing in Toledo, and that kind of brought the traditions from one place to another. So again, that's what makes the Ramban so significant. And of course, then you have the Rambam, which is going to be more down here on our map. And again, he's going to bring it up here. So he is at the crossroads, intellectual crossroads, of Jewish history during that time period. And I hope that you are all profoundly impressed by my ability to do this. Yes, Indra. Yeah.
Yeah. Are all prior to the Rambam, or are any of them at the same time?
As the Ramban? The Tosafists are still around. The Tosafists go into the 13th century.
Yeah.
The Gaonim have pretty much ended, have gone. Ibn Ezra and Rashi, Rambam, they basically, you know, if you're playing like a relay race, they're basically tagging the Ramban. That's how I view it. In other words, right as they're disappearing from the scene of Jewish history, the Ramban is emerging in Jewish history. And Kabbalah is actively being studied in Provence.
Kabbalah
is actively being studied in Provence during that time.
What was the time period of Kabbalah?
I don't have exact dates.
So, I'm a little bit confused about this, with these words intellectual crossroads. If these are all, some of them are way to hundreds of years behind, and some of them are at the same time period.
Great question,
and
right?
They don't have airplane travel, so how is it being crossroads, you know, how is it coming together if they're like all over the map?
So it's a good question. Because even though Ibn Ezra and Rashi are being studied in their geographical locations, right, and people in that area are aware of it, who's bringing it from one place to another? Notice, who else but the Ramban? Let's take Rashi and Ibn Ezra, because that's for our purposes tonight. Who else is merging those two traditions? Right? Ibn Ezra was around. Rashi was around. But Ramban, because of his geographical location, is made aware of both of them in perhaps a more profound, overt way, and therefore he's able to incorporate them into his works. That's what I mean by intellectual crossover.
They're behind him, right? They're working.
Yes. Yes. But again, things didn't. You didn't have email, so it took. Right. It took time to move things. Okay. So all of these are playing out in the works of the Ramban. Let's just take a second in terms of the Rambam. I'm going to hold your question for a second. Let's just take a look at the Rambam. So Rambam and Ramban are often contrasted with one another. Now, it's not just because they sound alike, which would be convenient for us. Right? They happen to sound alike. But there are many other distinct differences. You basically have two schools of thought amongst contemporary scholars. I'll share them both with you briefly. One defines it along the lines of reason and emotion, or Aristotelian versus feeling. Hey, they'll say the Rambam is very rational, the Rambam is reason-oriented, the Rambam is Aristotelian, whereas Ramban is going to quote Kabbalah a lot more, so he's going to be a lot of more of emotion, he's going to be a lot more filled with feeling. That's one approach. If you read the works of Solomon Schechter, he writes that, that's his thesis in describing the differences between Rambam, Maimonides, and Ramban, Nachmanides. Bernard Septimus, who has a brilliant article on this. You can get it online. I found it online. You just Google Bernard Septimus, Ramban, Ibn Ezra. I don't remember what exactly I Googled to get it. But you can find it. Bernard Septimus, of course, from Harvard. So he believes that Ramban is not necessarily opposed to Rambam, that he uses a lot of them, even though they disagree. But they're not as fierce competitors as we make them out to be. And in fact, he argues that Ramban is much more Sfaradi than he is Ashkenazi, which is somewhat counterintuitive to what I'm arguing tonight, but nonetheless, you can certainly read that online if you would like. But again, my general point is that the Ramban is at the crossroads between all of this that's taking place. And what's interesting, and this as we get more into his Parshanut, into an actual text, because I'm rapidly running out of time, right? As we get into one of his texts, what's interesting, I'm sorry, I can't, right? What's interesting is that he's going to incorporate all of these into his explanation. So he'll quote the Rambam in his Parish on the Torah sometimes. He'll quote Rashi, he'll quote Ibn Ezra. He won't necessarily quote the Tosfos. He'll quote Rashi a lot, but he'll quote Kabbalah a lot. So he's going to utilize, he's going to pick and choose from all different places, geographical, cultural, traditional, and incorporate them into his study of Tanakh. So let's look at one brief example. Source number 3, on page 4. Okay. Everyone has it? Okay. Page number 3, Breishit, source number 2 first. Breishit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim et ha-aret. What does the word Breishit mean?
The beginning.
In the beginning. Okay? So Rashi already says, if you look on source number 3, Katav Rashi, Rashi says, Ein ha-mikra ze omer ela darsheni. This verse says nothing but expound upon me. Rashi says that oftentimes. In other words, something is so esoteric that Rashi says, the text is screaming to you. Explain me, explain me, explain me. And so therefore Rashi quotes, I'm reading in the Ramban, but he's quoting Rashi. Okay? And I notice now the English doesn't say Katav Rashi. So the first part of the Ramban is really a quotation of Rashi. Okay? So what does Rashi go on to do? How does he explain the Pasuk? He says that the word Reshit in the beginning is utilized because of a midrash that says that there are several things in the Torah which are called Reshit, that are called the first. Torah is called Reshit, Yisrael is called Reshit, etc. And he gives other examples as well. Okay, so Rashi says the reason why it uses the word Bereshit, in the beginning, God Creator, or first God created, is to draw us to the fact that Torah, the Jewish people, the Bikurim, those are all going to, the first fruits, those are all going to be called Reshit. Now what does Rashi employ there to explain the Pasuk? He employs Midrash. He's employing Midrash to understand what he considers to be the simple understanding of the Pasuk. Okay, so immediately you see the Ramban is quoting Rashi. Then he comes along, turn to page 5. Let's read the English. First full paragraph, left-hand side. Now this midrash, if our sages, I assume that should be of our sages, is extremely vague and enigmatic. The same way all of you are looking at me and saying, what the heck is Rabbi Masu talking about? The first fruits, the first people, the first Torah. So Ramban's saying the exact same thing. It's very nice, Rashi, that you quoted the midrash, but you're just creating further problems. It's enigmatic midrash. It's a vague. It's esoteric. For they found many things that they are called the beginning in Tanakh. Right? The Midrash only quotes 3 examples, but Ramban says, I can find many more examples of where the word Reshit, where the word first is called, in Tanakh. And therefore, what does he do? He rejects Rashi. But how does he do it? He says, now this midrash, again, I'm just going to read, for this midrash of our sages is extremely vague and enigmatic. For they found many things that are called beginning in the Tanakh, and they have midrashim about all of them. In fact, those of little faith enumerate them condescendingly because they are so many. Who are those of little faith? No. Ibn Ezra.
No.
Right? What does Ibn Ezra do? He says condescendingly. Ibn Ezra looks at Rashi, who quoted a midrash, and he says, ah, Rashi, you're a fool. Right? You quote this midrash, which says that the reason why the word reshit is used is because there are three things that are called reshit. Well, Ibn Ezra says, me, the grammarian, I know that there are many other instances where the word reshit is employed. Furthermore, as I introduced, not every word in the Torah has to have cosmic significances, Rashi. You don't have to find a midrash for everything. So therefore, he rejects Rashi in his midrash. Comes along the Ramban, and what does he call him? He calls him in Hebrew, Vikatne Emuna. Those of little faith. Now remember the quote I said earlier, that you find a lot of the rebuke and a little bit of the hidden love, right? Ramban is not so generous in describing the Ibn Ezra. So what does Ramban do? Again, he's quoted Rashi. He rejects Rashi with Ibn Ezra, really, but he's giving a dig at Ibn Ezra as he's doing. And then he gives his explanation. And their intention is really to show that the word Breishit alludes to the fact that the world was created with 10 hypostases. Sphirot. I don't know what that English word means, but sphirot. In other words, what's a good definition of sphirot? Anyone help me?
Spheres,
right? The 10 spheres. Now, what is Ramban employing now? What does that sound? Kabbalah. Right, exactly. Now, isn't that strange a little bit that the Ramban is employing Kabbalah? Well, not so much. Because we know that Ramban is very aware of Kabbalah. But why does the Ramban use Kabbalah? Why does he choose to use Kabbalah? Well, who is he so angry at here?
Who were the Kabbalistics?
Ibn Ezra.
They started with the Kabbalah. Who were the Kabbalistics that he's based on?
Names?
Yeah.
I don't know names off the top of my head. I don't know.
He's angry. Well,
who's he angry at?
Ibn Ezra.
Ibn Ezra, exactly. Ibn Ezra, the ultimate rationalist, the ultimate grammarian. So there are multiple levels to what he's doing here. He rejects Rashi's Midrash. He uses the Ibn Ezra to reject Rashi's Midrash. But then he gives a dig at Ibn Ezra. And to reject Ibn Ezra's general philosophy, he quotes Kabbalah, which is the ultimate dig at the ultimate rationalist. Okay? And therefore, he says at the bottom, but I mention this to silence the mouths of those of little faith and lacking in wisdom who poke fun at the words of our rabbis. So you see, again, we're still in that same source. I'm just reading on in the English. I skipped to the next paragraph of the English. Okay? Again, I mention this. Why does he employ Kabbalah? To silence the mouths of those of little faith and lacking in wisdom who poke fun at the words of our rabbis. So again, he's pitting Rashi and Ibn Ezra against each other because those are his two main focuses. He told us that in his introduction. But he has no real allegiances. Right? He rejects Rashi. He rejects Ibn Ezra. He uses Kabbalah to reject Ibn Ezra. So he's doing things. This is why I said he's working on multiple planes at the same time. He's working a little bit in Midrash, a little bit in grammar, a little bit in Kabbalah, all in one explanation of a pasuk. And that's why I called it the multitasking, right, exegete. Because he's picking from all of these different cultures and all these different traditions and utilizing and incorporating them into his explanation. Yeah.
Does anyone have any issue that the writing is somewhat insulting and condescending?
Yeah.
Quite
yeah. Contemporary scholars point that out in a negative way. You have to learn rabbinic text is full of it. For example, Ramban and Balamor. But they say it with love. I mean that. I really mean that. Again, I don't know. I wasn't there.
It's hidden love.
We call it the Milchamta Shel Torah, right? The Battle of Torah. And that's really what it was. You have to remember that these aren't just. Let me answer you a little bit more in depth. These aren't just personalities. Right? In the time that the Ramban was writing, there's a tug and pull between different philosophies and how to understand the Torah. And you can view one as very dangerous if utilized exclusively. The Ramban clearly views the approach of Ibn Ezra as a dangerous approach if utilized in a vacuum. He also, by the way, views Rashi's approach somewhat misleading if used in a vacuum. The greatness of his biblical commentary is that he merges the two of them, picking and choosing from what he views as the best of each. And that's why he doesn't have allegiances. Whatever he believes is going to get him to the end goal is going to get him there. So this really was the Battle of Torah. In other words, the same way nowadays, or, you know, think about in the 19th century, the battle between Reform and, you know, and Orthodoxy, which was a very fierce battle, because it was a very real battle to them. This was the future of what Orthodoxy would look like. So for the Ramban, this was what the future of biblical exegesis was going to look like. It was a real issue with him. And in part of his polemic, remember, one of my things that I said he incorporates into his work is polemical. Part of his polemic is against the rationalists, is against the Ibn Ezra type of mentality. So your question is, you know, it drives it exactly the question. It makes these types of conversations dynamic and very real and very threatening to the Ramban, who says, I see what's going on down here, I see what's going on up there. I don't necessarily 100% agree with either one of them, but I have the ability to see the forest and to decide how I want to conduct my own personal. I'm really sorry. I haven't even touched a Barbanel yet. I'm happy to stay afterwards and address any and all questions, but I simply have to stop. I don't want to ask people to answer that. It's late. I would, but it's not fair to people either. Because then people are going to, do I leave? And I'm happy to stay late for anyone who wants to stay late. Okay. I am going... I had so much good material. You are being robbed of such rich things. But how about this? Let's go to the Ramban. And if I happen to finish a Barbanel a little bit early, which I might. I'll come back to the Ramban. Is that okay? So hold your Ramban mindsets, because we might come back to it. Okay. Let's go ahead now. Okay. Well, the real Barbanel, please stand up. Let's do a little of historical, biographical information of the Barbanel. Barbanel was born in 1437 in Lisbon, Portugal, to a wealthy, prominent family. Right? What do we call him? Don Yitzchak Barbanel. What does the name Don mean?
Sir.
Prince. It's a term for a Jewish elite, which traces back all the way to the Golden Age of Spain. So immediately within his name, you get a sense that he is born into an elite family. 1483, he is accused of trying to kill one of the dukes in Portugal, and that's how he makes his trek from Portugal to Spain. Spain is not a good place already in 1483. Right? What happened in 1482? If anyone was paying attention at the beginning. What happened in 1482? 1480s, that's when the Catholics decide to either Christianize or murder. Already we're in the time of the Inquisition, so it's not a very pleasant place to be. And that's where he finds his way into Spain. Immediately in Spain, again, who do we know this part, right? Who takes him in? Ferdinand and Isabella. They make him the finance minister over all of Spain. And if you think about it, right, it's literally the story of Purim. Right, as the Jews are being persecuted on the outside, he, Barbanel, is one of the highest ranking officials in all of Spain. In 1492, of course, the Jews are expelled. There is a historical debate about whether Barbanel knew about it or not. As we know, we obviously know he knows about it in hindsight when he's given the option of either staying or leaving. But while it was happening, no one knows about whether he knew about it definitively or whether he was somewhat shielded from it. Okay, in 1492, of course, the Christians finally conquer all of Spain. Barbanel runs away to Italy. It's in Italy where he wrote most everything. He wrote very little in Portugal and Spain. Almost everything that he writes takes place at the end of his life in Italy. Again, he's chosen, the dukes like him a lot. He's chosen for finance position. Once again, he's included in the court, and he dies in Venice in 1508. So if you think about it, he runs away in 1492 to 1508. Everything that he wrote happens in 16 years in Italy. Now he wrote a lot. And once he started going, the pen flowed. Now, as you see on top there, I have, will the real Abarbanel please stand up? And because I'm going to show you, I believe it's five statements which are going to cause you to cackle a little bit. Guaranteed cackling. Okay? Number one, from Nachum Sarna. I believe he lived here for a little bit.
Yes.
Right? Well, he used to sit next to me in Shul in Boston growing up. So that's how I know him. But Nachum Sarna, an article, wrote the following. On the whole, Abarbanel's commentaries are not of the highest caliber. In his avoidance of philological and grammatical observations, together with his prolixity, greatly limit their exegetical work. Not very flattering interpretation of Abarbanel. Basically, his prolixity, he writes too much, he's too verbose, he doesn't incorporate philological and grammatical observations like Ibn Ezra would have, it's not high caliber, very unflattering. Louis Rabinowitz, famous biblical personality, died 20 years ago. He writes about Abarbanel as an exegete, especially of the purely historical books of the Bible, both in his methods and the nature of his commentary. Abarbanel stands alone and without equal. And it is difficult to understand the latter-day neglect of him. Right? Directly contradictory. Next statement. Sid Lyman, Schneer Lyman. Again, still alive. Where is he? At Touro now? Brooklyn College? One of those. Few biblical commentaries have been accorded the acclaim and popularity enjoyed by Don Isaac Abarbanel's commentary. Right? He and he are basically writing at the same time. Right? He writes, not high caliber, not worth their exegetical work. Schneer Lyman comes along and says, what are you talking about? Few have been accorded the acclaim and popularity of Abarbanel's the creme de la creme. You have another statement. Meir Waxman, again. Biblical personality. Don Yitzchak Abarbanel was not an original thinker. Okay? And lastly, Louis Rabinowitz again. Abarbanel prides himself upon his originality. I promise you cackling, right? And it is a pride for which the study of his works provides a complete justification. So you have, what was it, five? Yeah, five. Five different texts which strongly contradict one another. And that's why I asked the question, will the real Abarbanel please stand up? And hopefully we'll understand why you have such a divergence of opinions, even amongst contemporary scholars, in reading the Abarbanel. I can't, I'm sorry. I'll take it at the end, okay? So come along here. The appreciation of Abarbanel's exegesis is impeded by three factors. There are basically three reasons why he is minimized. This is not mine. I should have quoted him. I'm sorry. On the bottom here, there's a great article by Chaim Angel, who is a Bible professor at Yeshiva University, who's published in Tradition on the 500-year anniversary of Abarbanel's, the first publication of Abarbanel's text. So he has a whole article about it. In there, he struggles with the fact that Abarbanel isn't necessarily as widely studied as some of the other commentaries. He articulates three reasons. Number one is a tendency to relativize his comments to historical settings in personal life. What does that mean? It means the following. I mean, you could all understand English, but let me try to explain it a little bit. Essentially what it means is that we love to read history into our biblical commentaries. Okay? And we're not wrong to do it. The biblical commentaries were real personalities, they were real people, and it's impossible to read Abarbanel without recognizing the time period in which he lived. So for example, we'll see in a second when Abarbanel talks about the monarchy and the dangers of the monarchy, it's a very real conversation for him. The problem is when you solely approach Abarbanel through that prism, then it becomes problematic. Because then you get statements like that, okay? Not the highest caliber, avoidance of philological and grammatical observations. Right? What's he essentially saying? He's saying he didn't really study the texts of the Torah. Because to do that, you need to understand the grammar, etc., etc., etc. What did he do? He looked at his life experiences and wrote based on that. That minimizes Abarbanel. That undermines the very essence of what he's trying to do. So there is a general tendency to relativize his comments, either because of history or personal life. That undermines the integrity of what he does. He is a brilliant biblical scholar. He uses grammar. He utilizes the text of the Torah. And I'll show you an example, God willing. Okay? Number two, the reason why it's impeded, is the balance of creativity and traditionalism. As we'll see in a second, one of the when we talk about the structure of Abarbanel, he will always quote a plethora of opinions before suggesting his own opinion. Some people look at that and say, he's just a traditionalist. There's a lack of creativity on his point. He's just quoting Rashi and Ramban, etc., etc., etc. So what do we need to bother studying him for? Now again, that's a grotesque misunderstanding of Abarbanel. Abarbanel, and I'll show you one example, was one of the most creative thinkers. And number three is the preference for philology and grammar, namely that he doesn't prefer to them, that there's this implication that he doesn't utilize them as much. So for quote-unquote real biblical scholars to not use philology and grammar is a tragedy. Again, so I want to share that with you because that thought is out there that Abarbanel's exegesis doesn't take hold the same way that some of the other personalities do. But I think it is a gross misunderstanding of what it is he's actually trying to do. Let's fly through the Abarbanel so that we can see something inside. I just want to give you two examples. The tendency to relativize his comments to historical settings and personal life. Again, one of the things he talks about is a monarchy a commandment of the Torah or simply permitted? When the Torah in Devarim tells the Jewish people that they can have a king, the question is that because God wanted it? Or God is simply saying, you, the people, wanted it and I will allow it. Those are two very different things. Rambam comes along and says that it's actually a positive commandment to have a king. Abarbanel comes along and says, yeah, it's permitted yet frowned upon. Now, we will read into this the historical context of which the Abarbanel's writing. He says, you want to know how troubling and problematic kings can be? Well, let me tell you. Because they decided to throw out all the Jews from Spain. Now, that's a very easy thing to read and to think that that's the only reason why the Abarbanel came to this decision. What you have to understand is that what's a disagreement between Rambam and Abarbanel is really a dispute in the Gemara itself. There's a machlokas between... I had notes on this somewhere. I can't seem to find them. There's a machlokas, there's a dispute within the Gemara as to whether it is a mitzvah or whether it's okay but not, you know, not permitted to be frowned upon. And Rambam and Abarbanel are simply choosing sides. So obviously Abarbanel is incorporating his life experiences into his writings, but he's not pulling them out of thin air. That's what I want to show you. That when we talk about relativizing his comments to historical settings of personal life, of course they are incorporated into it, but don't think that he simply came up with it because of those life experiences. He bases himself on rabbinic texts, right? He bases himself on rabbinic texts, and It bases himself on rabbinic text, and that will speak to where he ultimately concludes, but no one should think he pulls it out of thin air. That's one of the things I want to show you. We talk about the balance of creativity in traditionalism. So you have here on one of your handouts, which I myself didn't keep for myself, ironically enough. Let's actually hold this for a second. But grab this one, the one that has both sides, a one and a two. Okay? This is important. If you come away with nothing else from the study of the Abarbanel, you should remember these four steps. The Abarbanel, every single commentary on the Torah, follows the exact same structure. And you need that because the Abarbanel is exceedingly verbose. That's another reason why it's oftentimes not learned. It A, has never been translated into English, and B, it's very long. It's very tedious. But it's the exact same approach each time. Number one is he divides the portion into smaller thematic parts. Okay, so he is not going to go pasuk by pasuk like Rashi will, like Ibn Ezra will. But what will he do? He'll take a part of the Torah. For example, the hitting of the rock, which we'll look upon in a second. Right? He'll take that bulk of psukim, that bulk of verses, and he'll merge them into one conversation. So he won't go verse by verse. Number two, he will then structure his entire comments in a question and answer format. He will ask many questions. The example they gave you in this text He asks 17 questions on one part of the Torah, on just the beginning of Lech Lecha. On the May Meriva, the hitting of the rock, he asks 7 questions. So again, he'll take a part of the Torah, he'll ask countless questions on it, and then he'll go one by one in answering the questions. So it takes a tremendous amount of patience to study. Before he gets to his answers, he's going to survey all opinions on the text. So he'll say, Rashi says this, Ibn Ezra says this, Ramban says this, this guy, and sometimes he won't even quote names. He'll say, Anashim, there are people who say this, and there are other people who say that. That's why, remember what I said, one of the reasons why people try to minimize him is because people view him as a traditionalist. All he's doing is rehashing other opinions. That's not all he does. That's one of the steps of what he does. And lastly, number 4, is he's going to offer an innovative understanding of how to understand the text itself. So what I want to do, let's take a poll. Show of hands. We can study the text in your sheets, which has English, but I personally believe is not as exciting. Or I can study this, which I'll promise to read very little, translate everything, but I think is much more exciting.
More exciting.
Raise of hands. Who wants to do the sheets that you have in front of you? Who wants to do my sheet? Okay. I just want to know. So now if it's not exciting, I'm in trouble. No.
We have an echo.
What? The copy's over there. Okay? They were given out at the beginning. Okay. If you turn to where it says page 1. Again, it's the double-sided, very small Hebrew print. Now already, immediately, I've basically deterred 99% of you of ever opening up a Ramban for the rest of your life. Because you see the small print in the et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I promise you I'm going to make it easy for you. Okay? Because we're going to peripherally study. Okay? Okay. Page number 1, top right-hand corner. Where you see the second line, there's a big Hebrew letter. What he does there is, again, he's just going to quote a bulk of Psukim. He's going to say the general period of the Torah into which he's writing. And if you look down, just skim, I have 7 underlines in a row. He asks 7 questions on the text of the Torah. Now, what are we talking about here? We're talking about the part of the Torah which is most troubling. Moshe Rabbeinu is told to speak to the rock. What does he do?
Yes,
hits the rock, and he's told immediately he can't go into Israel. No one reads the Torah and is not bothered by that. Because he hit a rock, he can't go into Israel. And that's essentially what the Abarbanel asks. One after another question. Why couldn't Moshe go into Israel? Why is that fair of God? Why this? Why that? Again, one after another, asking 7 questions into the text. Then if you look on the left side of the page, where I have an arrow in the middle of the text, he then goes, V'hineni modiacha ha-de'ot, now I will tell you the various opinions, Ashiraiti bedrush hazeh, which I saw on this part of the Torah, ad hayom mechachmei ha-mefarshim, that I saw to this day from the wise exegetes of the Torah, v'amechabrim, umashi yikshel adat dat mehem, and I'm going to explain how they understand question by question. So what have we seen? Again, he's divided the portion into a smaller thematic part. He's asked 7 questions. Before he gets to his answer, he's going to survey all opinions on the text. And again, without going inside, just look at my underlines. The first underline, Vehiviu Rashi. First he quotes Rashi. The second underline, he quotes Ve'adeot Hasheni Hu Lechazal. He doesn't quote anyone in particular. He says there's a rabbinic perspective out there. Third underline on the left-hand side, Ve'adeot Ve'adat HaGimel Hu L'Rav HaGadol HaMaimoni. He quotes Rambam. Fourth one, Ramban. Fifth one, he calls them Anashim, Amru Anashim. Their people say. But again, what's he doing exactly this? He's simply surveying all opinions that he has seen on the text. Turn the page. Top of the right hand side, Ve'adat HaZayin. The 7th opinion is Anashim Acherim, is other people, right? The 8th opinion, 2nd underline, the Ibn Ezra, right? An acronym at the end of that underline stands for Harab Avram Ben Ezra. Hey, Ibn Ezra. And lastly, he quotes the Sefer Yikarim, Rav Yosef Alba. Okay, so he's quoted now 9 different opinions. And then he's going to explain his own created understanding of the text. Okay? Go down on the right-hand side of page 2 where I have an underline, about two-thirds down from the end of the page. So again, he's done all of our steps so far. Thematic, questions, surveying all opinions, and now he comes to the answer. And the reason why I want to study this is because I think it's such a novel approach. And I think it helps showcase his creative thinking. He suggests the following in the story of the hitting of the rock. He says, really, Moshe and Aaron aren't punished for the hitting of the rock at all. Wait a second. Torah itself says that they're punished for this hitting of the rock. What are you telling me, Barbanel, they're not punished for the hitting of the rock? Really, he says it's all one big smoke screen. What does that mean, it's one big smoke screen? Really, they're supposed to be punished for other things. That Moshe is supposed to be punished for the sin of the spies. And that Aaron is supposed to be punished for the golden calf, for agreeing and helping along the Jewish people. But what would have happened if the Torah said that Moshe was punished for an egregious sin, like rebelling against God and sending spies in, and Aaron was being punished for a grievous sin of idolatry? What would we think of Moshe and Aaron?
Less.
We think less of them. So what does Abarbanel say Hashem does? He finds a trivial sin. Hit a rock. What's so bad about that? And that's the reason they're not allowed into Israel. It's a smokescreen. Really, they're being punished for much more grave sins. But the Torah doesn't want to admit to that. So what does it do? It creates this trivial sin. It says, you're punished for that. So that we, in this room, will never know the true reason, the true seriousness of the sin that will not allow them to go into Israel. Now, I don't know if you're what you're thinking, but to me that's a very creative approach. That's a very out-of-the-box way of looking at that entire story plot, and if you had given me 100 chances, I'm not sure I would have guessed that one. But why do I share it with you? Because, again, it's so dramatically different than all of the other opinions that you'll have seen. And it shows the nature of the creativity, of the innovative nature of Abarbanel himself. What else does Abarbanel do? And again, this is just in terms of stylistic within the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel will oftentimes defend biblical personalities. Right? You have different exegetes will do different things. Abarbanel is the ultimate defender. And you see that within the text that we just wrote. He read, he doesn't want Moshe and Aaron to get a bad rap in the Torah, so he irks out a way to make them look a little bit better. What else do you see? Just from the nature of the text that I gave you, his texts are very verbose. He can go on for 15 pages on one piece, on two psukim of the Torah, which is extremely difficult to go through. This is even before the iPad generation where our brains can last for about 3 seconds on something before you have to go to something else, right? It's very challenging to go through. What else do I want to point out? Again, he weaves theology and exegesis. Okay? Think about his, let's take an example. Think about his, I don't have a good example off the top of my head, but oftentimes he will incorporate theology into the very essence of his biblical commentary. Now, why is that significant? Because one of the reasons I said that we're studying Ramban and Abarbanel at the same time is because they're both working on multiple planes. And I want to show you that Abarbanel is doing that as well. Okay, just a few final trends within Abarbanel's writing. Okay?
He wrote in Rashi itself.
What?
He wrote in Rashi.
That's the printer. That's the printer. Okay. Number one is Abarbanel is unique in the sense that he does not write a lot on the Talmud the same way the Ashkenazim do. He's really one of the first personalities to study Tanakh. He studies Tanakh, philosophy, etc. That's number one in terms of intellectual trend. So again, he's not, you don't find a commentary of the Abarbanel on the Talmud, but you find it extensively on Tanakh. Number two, he's part of a long tradition of Jewish polemicists who respond to Christian polemics. Number three, he does not shy away from dialoguing with Christian scholars. Abarbanel will oftentimes quote Christian opinions in his text, which is somewhat unique within that day and age. Number four, he utilizes philosophy, so he's part of the anti-intellectual tradition, right? The intellectual tradition of central Spain. He is somewhat counter to that by the nature of the fact that he uses philosophy. Okay? Number five, he has a love-hate relationship with the Rambam. Sometimes he's going to love him, sometimes he's going to hate him. Number six, he's part of the Italian Renaissance. So for example, he will say brave things that may not necessarily be rooted in tradition, but he's very comfortable doing that. Number seven is, although he knows that he knows Kabbalah and he utilizes Kabbalah. And lastly is his ability that he wrote historical literature, that he feels the need to record the events of Jewish history. His commentary on, I forget it off the top of my head, but I believe it's Yeshua. Where he records in detail his experiences with the expulsion of Spain in 1492. Again, and that's what makes it such a fascinating text, is that he's not just writing a commentary on the Torah, but he incorporates all of those in as well. Okay, we have 2 minutes left. Let's come back. Let's do a little summary. Okay. We studied two very different personalities tonight. We studied the Ramban, which, as we said, sat at the crossroads, the intellectual crossroads, between many different cultural, traditional, philosophical events in Jewish history. That on the one hand, he sits in the middle of Ibn Ezra and Rashi, and he's incorporating the rationalist, grammatical approach of the Ibn Ezra with the midrashic approach of Rashi. He's using Kabbalah to take a knock at Rashi, at Ibn Ezra. At the same time, he has that love-hate relationship with Ibn Ezra. He's not afraid to use Kabbalah. He argues strongly with the Rambam, although it's not so clear how much they viewed each other as, or how much he viewed the Rambam in a negative light, or he simply disagreed with him, right? But he clearly disagrees with Rambam in a lot of places. His commentary in the Torah, he disagrees with him. He disagrees with him, obviously, in the Sefer HaMitzvos, in the calculation of the mitzvos themselves, etc. In the Talmud, he's bringing the work of the Tosafists, in the approach of the Tosafists, that give and take, that reconciling textual contradictions, he's bringing that and incorporating it into the styles of the southern Spain rabbis. Sits at that intellectual crossroads. When we talk about Abarbanel, we are talking about the end of that spectrum. We're talking about the end of Christian Europe, before the Jews are expelled from Spain, which is essentially the full culmination of that period of Spain, which is rich with rabbinic writings. And again, we learned the four basic ways to understand any structure of the Abarbanel. Number one is he goes thematic. Number two, he goes a question and answer format. Number three, he's going to quote a whole slew of opinions. And number four, he's going to come to his ultimate creative, innovative approach. And that bookends the entire period of Christian Spain through the expulsion. And that takes us to the end of the class.